The MSU Symphony Orchestra and several university choruses are taking on the epic Mahler Third Symphony on Saturday, and Current State's Melissa Benmark talked with MSU Director of Orchestras Kevin Noe about the concert. Hi, Melissa.
Mark, I walked in earlier this week, and Kevin Noe handed me the score, and he said, "Feel how heavy this is." And I said, "How's it going?" And he laid it across his shoulders. Because it is a weight. It
wow.
is a serious, serious undertaking, but one that the payoff we know is going to be fantastic. And Kevin Noe, very enthused about performing the Mahler 3.
This one doesn't get nearly as much playtime as some of the others because of those proportions, I think. And because it takes a lot of extra people. You know, you have to have 9 horns minimum. You know, you've got a lot of extra things. The wind section is very big. And I think the average professional player, even in a major orchestra, if you ask them, you know, over a 25-year career in the Detroit Symphony, Pittsburgh Symphony, Chicago Symphony, how many times have you played Mahler 1? And they would say, I don't know, 60. And how many times have you played 2? And they would say 35. And how many times have you played 3? And they would say 4. Maybe something like that. It just doesn't come up. For whatever reason, it's also not quite caught on the way the others have done. And as I've worked on the piece, I think I understand what it is. It's not something that the work is flawed by any means. It's that there is a kind of cantankerous nature to what he's doing. There's an unpredictability about all of it that he himself admitted to. That flexibility, that freedom about where we're going, that freedom in the narrative and freedom in the agenda that is somewhat less man-made in this symphony, I think it's something that's harder to get close to. And you need several hearings to where you really begin to understand what he's really doing. And it's quite extraordinary.
This was written late, very late 1800s. And I understand that there are some parts in it that even are meant to not be in time, that like a piccolo part that is supposed to just play almost sort of randomly against the beat. Do you think he was kind of foreshadowing some of the stuff that was going to happen in 20th century music in this?
I think Mahler was definitely all about progress. I don't know that he was concerned with so much where music was headed. I mean, he was an egomaniac in the best sense of the word. He was concerned with where he was headed, you know. And this idea that you mentioned is something that comes up in all of the symphonies that I've worked with of his, where he has people play things that are not exactly in time with everything else going on around it. And of course, offstage things that you really wouldn't have expected during that time period. That seems like a much later invention. But in this case, he does it, I suppose, more often, and I think the reason is he is trying to grapple with the idea of Earth sounds. It's not exactly Earth sounds. It's the idea of Earth's energy giving birth to life. And that requires, as I said, a less of a man-made, predictable, forced, you know, everybody fitting into the same puzzle approach. So you get this kind of strange bird calls off to the side. You get this magnificent trumpet solo in the third movement. It's known as the post-horn solo. That is a wonderful and beautiful, beautiful passage and very spiritual, but it almost doesn't even seem to fit into the rest of the work. It's like something that you wander off into the forest or near this, actually the real story is near a gravesite, and you wind up experiencing this thing. So I think he was combining a number of elements and trying to use a different kind of compositional technique to assemble them. And certainly as I and some of my students have been working on trying to analyze formally what's going on, it is troubling that it doesn't fit into our neat little boxes. It would be much easier for us. I'm sure he doesn't care one bit. In fact, he's probably laughing right now that we're struggling, you know. But it's definitely been worth it. I mean, it's an honor to spend hundreds of hours on such a masterpiece.
Bing, bong, bing, bong, bing, bong, bing, bong, bing, bong, bing, bong.
let's see here. You're dealing with a large orchestra, several choruses, harps, tuned bells, glockenspiels for crying out loud. I mean, this thing should come with a manual. How long has it taken you to put together the logistics of how to rehearse this?
I'm still at it. I'm still redesigning, hoping that we get it right today. I don't know. I mean, the architecture of the thing is a beast on every level. And to play through the notes is a fairly straightforward process. To understand what you're playing, to inhabit those notes, and to play them with intention and understanding that is communicative to the audience, that is a very grand task.
He started out with some program notes, Pan Awakes, Summer Marches In, it lined up with the movements, What the Flowers in the Meadow Tell Me, What the Man Tells Me, What the Angels Tell Me, etc. And then later on, it sounds like he kind of got away from that and then kind of completely refused to explain it later on in terms of there being any kind of programmatic theme to this. How do you get the musicians to know what it is they're supposed to be bringing forth from these movements?
Well, I mean, I suppose as the conductor, you use any means at your disposal, whatever it would take to get them to understand. In this case, you know, this is something that Mahler does. He does this. He'll write program notes. He'll leave an extensive trail of dialogue between himself and a friend about all these things that the symphony mean. Very, very detailed work. And he'll cite passages from the scripture, passages from Nietzsche, poems that he likes. This is what I was doing here. It's just like this. He'll make these analogies to so-and-so. He'll talk deeply about his inspirations. And he'll print these in program notes and then revise them over and over until he gets them just right. And then at the last second, he'll pull them all off and take it all away. This is what he does. This is his pattern. And I think there are a variety of things going on there. I mean, my sense of the man is that he's sly like a fox, that he likes very much knowing that people throughout human history will continue to play this music and will continue to look back through the notes, through the letters, as I have, as other conductors do, to try to understand the root intentions that are going on and to help let that help us feckin' every note with meaning, rather than here it is in plain English, this is exactly what it means, and most importantly, this is all that it means. Because music never only means one thing, you know? It's never complete until the listener fills in the true ending for themselves. So, in this case, I haven't forgotten about any of these titles. Pan Awakes, these things are still with me when I conduct. I'm also mindful of the fact that he doesn't feel it is strictly a programmatic work, and that it has to be taken in a symphonic context, and there are ways in which that has definitely affected my interpretation. But there are ways in which what Knight or Man tells me, you know, the fourth movement there that you were citing, what Mankind tells me, used to be called What Knight Tells Me up until the last version. And you know, there used to be a seventh movement, as if six wasn't enough. And the seventh movement was going to be what now has turned out to be the last movement in four. Fascinating, right? How it's all scrambling one big work. This is why the divisions between Symphony 1, 2, and 3, 4, it's not very meaningful to me. He wrote a symphony that's 10 symphonies long and many, many movements, you know. So it's always a pleasure to work with him. He's always challenging you on every level.
I have, I would say, a working knowledge of classical music, but Mahler is a real blank spot for me. I almost get the impression, it kind of reminds me of Joyce, if you're an English major, that everybody thinks they ought to read James Joyce, but they're not sure why. So why do we want to hear the Mahler Third?
Because at least within the first four symphonies, Mahler is trying to grapple with something that is almost impossible to articulate with words, something that is ancient and something that makes us us, something that makes humans what they are, something that makes life what it is. And he's trying to stir kind of primal feelings within you that I don't see how you could get at any other way. There are certainly other works in other mediums that have tried to some degree to stir this, but there is a kind of primal unrest that music can create that's unlike anything else. And the Mahler Third is nothing if not about trying to give form to a kind of primal unrest that gives rise to life And ultimately, in his trajectory, at least for the Third Symphony, gives rise to love. So I think he sees it as the highest trajectory from lifeless rock to human love. Why wouldn't you want to go hear that?
Kevin, no, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.